The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. I'm speaking with Karen Marie Marmer and Jörg Michael Schwartz, who are the co-founders and co-leaders of Rebel Baroque Ensemble. Welcome.
Very nice to be here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So I want to start with sort of the big obvious thing and start with the name of your group. You've got a double meaning to it, and I'm wondering if that was intentional and if you can sort of explain that.
Well, it's very interesting because it didn't start out to be intentional, but sort of evolved into being intentional, shall we say. When we were founded in 1991, actually, Jörg and I were living in Amsterdam, and originally we had formed the ensemble with a Dutch continuo section. And we, the first piece we played together as a group, just for fun, was the Tombeau de Monsieur de Lully by Jean-Ferry Rebel. And what happened was, I'll just tell you very briefly, that there was an opportunity that presented itself to us whereby there was a competition in Utrecht, the neighboring city, to Amsterdam, where they were taking applications from ensembles in early music, and we were not yet officially a group. We had to come up with a name because we wanted to enter the competition, and we thought, okay, let's call ourselves Les Elements. Les Elements was a piece by Jean-Ferry Rebel, and we found out that there was a gamba consort that had that name, so we had to very quickly come up with another name. And we were just going back and forth, and after a couple of days of frustration, I said, why don't we just call ourselves Ensemble Rebel? And that's how the name started.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of wasn't really a premeditated thing, but the way it kind of evolved was that we were kind of known for our provocative interpretations and kind of a dynamic style of playing, and I think that
what's very interesting is that initially it was Ensemble Rebel, and then a few years later we changed to just Rebel, and then to clarify, it's Ensemble for Baroque Music. And of course, when we took the name just Rebel, in English, of course, everybody pronounces it Rebel, and that's where the duality came in. And we sort of thought, because of our, as some people might call it, slightly rebellious, very vivid and energetic style of playing on these early instruments, period instruments, Baroque instruments, let's have it be that way, because that will spark some interest, and it sure did. And people always ask about, oh, where did you get that name from? And it's a good piece of conversation.
It is. So I'm curious, do you think that the reputation for provocative, I believe, is the word you used, Karen, and sort of different interpretations. Do you think that that is well deserved? Is that intentional itself, or is there more to that? Is that just the hype?
Well, it's not the hype. I would say probably in this country, you know, there are many different styles of Baroque playing. I want to say Baroque as opposed to medieval or Renaissance, which is not our field. There's a British style, which is kind of very elegant, and, you know, there's a German style, a Cologne style, which is very robust and energetic and kind of very heavily articulated. There's the Dutch style. I'm not going to go into all the other styles. But in this country, I think that our style of playing is a bit different than most other groups playing our repertoire, in that we kind of go for a really, really huge dynamic range, a lot of articulation, a very kind of lively vocabulary of articulations, and we're not afraid to make ugly sounds when and where it's asked for in the music, or when and where we think it might serve the music. We like to think of ourselves as having the whole gamut. So it's kind of a different style in terms of what American ensembles customarily play in. And so I suppose hopefully that answers part of your question.
I'm curious, too, because from what I understand, you've got a kind of a core group of five players. Mm-hmm. So there are three other people that you would sort of normally play with, and then you would augment that with other musicians as needed, basically, depending on whatever you're playing. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. What the issue in Baroque music is that there may be hundreds or even thousands of pieces with the same formation. Let's say the famous trio sonata, which of course has a minimum of four players usually, let's say for two violins, a harpsichord, and a cellist. And there may be other fixed formations, but the beauty of Baroque music really is that it always asks for different formations depending on what the music wants to evoke and what it wants to say, what story it wants to tell, so to speak. And so we have to be rather flexible. We can't be like, let's say, a modern string quartet that only and exclusively plays in that string quartet formation. So we have stuff when there's a flute or a recorder asked for, or an oboe, another wind instrument, or we need larger forces in the strings. We venture into concerti grossi, into overtures, into other descriptive pieces, or as small as a single recorder sonata for two or three people. That is because any solo instrument always needs, in Baroque, needs the basso continuo, which is a combination of different instruments such as the keyboard, organ, or harpsichord, and a cello, possibly sometimes a plucked instrument, could be a guitar, Baroque guitar, of course, or a theorbo, which is a, a stretched-out six-foot version of a lute. And so, you know, there are all these variables in Baroque music, which is, in a way, seems to make it complicated, but it is actually the beauty of the beast, and the variety of sounds that we can get with all these different formations is what makes Baroque music so flamboyant and fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So, now, if I'm correct, you both play Baroque violin and viola, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's correct, yeah.
So, I'm sort of guessing you didn't start on those instruments. I'm wondering how each of you got into music and, you know, what instruments you played, maybe what you started out on, and whether you came out of musical families.
In my case, if I may start on this question, or rather on the answer to the question, of course, I started on what we now, just for lack of a better term, call modern violin, which is the violin that you see in any regular symphony orchestra with a chin rest, with a shoulder rest, possibly with steel strings and stuff. And that's what I started out with. At a relative early age, my father was a church organist in South Germany. That's where I'm originally from, near the Stuttgart area in the south. And he, of course, his favorite as a Protestant church organist, his favorite composer, of course, was Johann Sebastian Bach, and Buxtehude and Rosenmüller, all those wonderful composers. And so I got into that music from very early on. And then when I went down the professional road, you know, went to conservatory and music school, etc., we forgot about all that music because the professional music schools, you know, there is basically hardly any music being played before Bach, which means about anything before 1720 does not really exist. And then we go into romantic music very quickly. There's Mozart and Haydn, perhaps a little bit, and then Beethoven, and then you come to the big romantic and 20th century composers, and that's what you learn. And so once I had studied at different schools in Switzerland, in Bern in Switzerland, in Cologne in Germany, and then came to Juilliard here in New York City, that's the repertoire that I learned, all the big violin concertos. And at some point, I got acquainted with a wonderful man who has just passed away a couple of years ago, Albert Fuller, who was a harpsichordist, but he was actually an organ teacher at Juilliard, and he taught some theory classes about different styles of music, et cetera, et cetera. And I got to meet him, and he sort of turned me around, if I want to use that term for lack of a better one, and got me again interested in Baroque music, which had been secretly my love ever since I started playing music. And then I, of course, what goes along with that is to look at the appropriate instruments, and that's when the Baroque violin comes in, that has no chin rest, has no shoulder rest, of course, has plain gut strings, no fine tuners, no metal on there, and a different interior setup, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just part of the going into that kind of music, and now I've been doing it for basically 25 years and for almost 20 years exclusively.
What about you, Karen?
Well, you know, I originally wanted to be a string quartet musician. That was my first love. And I met my second love in my husband. he introduced me to the wonderful world of Baroque music, actually Baroque and classical music on original instruments. And I fell in love with that, too. And that was in 1988. And that kind of changed my life because I originally was getting my master's degree at the Yale School of Music in Modern Violin, and I decided to take a real different direction, a real different turn, and didn't finish my my studies at Yale, and we moved to Holland, and I actually started studying Baroque violin with Lucy van Dahl at the Royal Conservatory in The Hague, and the rest is history. I'm just, I've never looked back, and I'm just thrilled doing what I'm doing.
You know, I know a number of musicians who specialize in Baroque and early music have told me that when they got their hands on their instrument for the first time, it was like coming home. It was something that just felt so natural, felt so right. Did you have that kind of an experience when you sort of made that transition?
I totally had that experience. And the interesting thing is that before I got my hands on an actual Baroque violin, York had given me some recordings to listen to. They were actually English concert under Trevor Pinnock, and some orchestral music by Handel Concerti Grossi or something like that. And I just fell in love with the style, but this music played in this style, and I actually practiced in my mind how it must feel to play this way. So when I finally got my hands on a Baroque violin, it almost felt like I had been playing it already.
So you play kind of some off-the-beaten-path music, too, you know, on that instrument, on those instruments, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to do a lot of research before you ever get your hands on your violin or your viola. So what's that process like to figure out whether you're going to play Bieber or Rossi or something like that and try to sort of go through the process of creating a program and actually learning that music?
One of the first things that one really has to do is to realize that besides the dozens and dozens of pieces that are top repertoire and that everybody plays, you know, never mind Baroque instruments or other, that there is, that is only the tip of the iceberg, and the iceberg being the complete repertoire of Baroque music. I mean, we're talking about at least 150, 160 years of what we would call Baroque music, from the very early beginnings around 1600 to the slow but eventual fade out around the 1750s or 1760s, and the turn into Rococo, and then eventually what we consider classical music, as in Mozart and Haydn, etc. And so when you realize that the tip of the iceberg is what everybody at the time, you know, had been playing. The majority of all this is, of course, the repertoire that we then eventually have to dig up and look for, and then you have to do some research, ask other people what repertoire is there, and you have to do a lot of reading and figure out what there is, and then how do I get my hands on it, because it's all great and beautiful if you know all the repertoire there is, or a lot of it, but you have to figure out where do we get editions, where do we get parts, do we get some manuscripts, and a lot of the stuff, now it's a little better than it was 20 or 30 years ago, was not published. The past couple decades, a lot of music has now come out in manuscript reprints or actual modern editions, and so a lot of research goes into that, and then once you have the stuff, and of course, in the meanwhile, Ravel, we have a huge library here, which is far from complete or anything. I mean, nobody would be able to house all the Baroque music there is. And, you know, we have, from what we have here in our library, we have maybe touched 5 or 10% at maximum. So there is an unbelievable amount of music, and not to say that every single piece that was written in Baroque times is a masterpiece. Far from it, just like in any other century and time, that's not the case. But there is an almost unlimited amount of repertoire of music that is definitely worth to listen to, and we find one gem after another.
And I want to add also that there's nothing more exciting than getting your hands on a piece of music that nobody has heard, mm-hmm. Much less recorded, and basically just discovering it and making something of it and learning how much of a masterpiece it is, if it is a masterpiece. And even if it isn't, we can just, you know, bring out a specialness that that's inherent in the piece. And it's just such an exciting process.
Hmm. Do you each have, a composer or a couple of composers you consider sort of the underrated masters, maybe people who were undeservedly obscure now?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of them, of course, is Heinrich Franz Ignaz von Bieber, B-I-B-E-R, mm-hmm. Where we have a wonderful CD of some of his two violin basso continuo suites, where each of the violins is in a scortatura tuning. That means in a different tuning than what usually violins are tuned in. And of course, he's written a lot more pieces. The Mystery Sonatas are his best-known opus, I would say. He's now a little better rated because people have realized what eccentric but wonderful music it is. There is Johann Rosenmüller, a German, who emigrated not by leisure, but had to emigrate to Italy, ended up in Venice, and only came back to South Germany at the very end of his life. And Karen, you may have some other composers.
There's a composer that everybody knows, but I think that he's really underrated. And it's a composer that we play a lot of, and that is Telemann. In fact, I like to call York a telemaniac, because every time we make a program, there is Telemann in there, no matter what. I shouldn't say any program, but we try to do a lot. Telemann was a more prolific composer than Bach, and I believe the pity of this composer is that he kind of lives in the shadow of the great master of Johann Sebastian Bach.
And Handel as well.
And he wrote, the imagination and innovation that this composer brought to the fore is just astonishing. You know, he was a master of the mixed style of, he wrote in the Italianate style and the French style and the Polish style, and he's such an imaginative, colorful composer, and I think that it's fair to say that we champion his music, and we've recorded a lot of his music, and we will continue to do so. But it's really great.
And to make the point even further, the fact is that George Frideric Handel stole hundreds of motifs and themes from Telemann pieces, particularly his best-known work, which is a huge, or three productions that are called Tafelmusik, intended as table music, so to speak. And each of those productions has about eight pieces in there, I mean, from trio sonatas to solo sonatas to overtured big suites and concerto. And Handel, he must have felt like the kitty in the toy store or something, and he just freely helped himself to all these motifs and themes, and just took them and wrote his own pieces and wrote wonderful pieces about from these stolen goods. But that's how even the now much better known contemporaries of Telemann really admired Telemann. You know, of course, nobody gave credit back then.
Mm-hmm. But, the patent and trademark office.
he was very highly rated at the time, and he was actually much more famous than Johann Sebastian Bach. And, I guess Handel eventually rivaled him in his fame when he went to London, of course, and became the big man there, mm-hmm. and Telemann was the big man in Germany.
Mm-hmm. So who is the next musical, hidden musical genius that you are going to introduce us to? What kind of musical projects do you have coming up in the future?
Well, we have several things. First of all, our next concert that is taking place in our Westchester Musica Antiqua Nova series in Bedford, New York, on May 3rd, that is going to be very interesting because we will have strings and continuo only. And, of course, we have Handel and Telemann on the program, a concerto grosso and an overture suite by Telemann. But we have some very obscure composers that, till not too long ago, I have to admit, not even I knew about that. And, you know, I will just give you a little sampling. There is Johann Caspar Ferdinand Fischer. Mm-hmm. There is Jakob Scheifelhut. Ooh. And there's Johann Abraham Schmierer, composers, all German composers, of course, that worked mostly in South Germany, in Augsburg. And we discovered that music a little while ago, and they wrote beautiful pieces in the French style, some in only French influence. And so we're going to bring out a few of those overtures and suites. That's the very next project that we have.
And I'd be willing to put money on the fact that this will be North American premiere of these pieces.
I mean, the likelihood is 99.999%. Then, of course, we have other projects coming up with perhaps also lesser-known composers, but we're going to be venturing into a wonderful program with a U.S. tour in November this year with Spanish music. Karen can maybe tell you a little bit more about that.
Yes, we're doing a Spanish program in November of 2009 with a very wonderful soprano, Marta Almohano, who comes from Zaragoza, and we're doing a program called Kingdoms and Viceroys, the Music of Spain and its Dominions. So it will include actually Latin American music as well as Spanish music, and we'll also feature our other guest artist, Richard Savino, on Baroque guitar. And as far as future projects, we are right now discussing plans to record a Leclerc disc. Jean-Marie Leclerc wrote some very, very wonderful trio sonatas and also violin duos. So we're talking about that. And our next CD is already in the can is going to include the Telemann string quintets. That's two violins, two violas, and basso continuo. As well as several flute quartets, which will feature Matthias Mauter, who is our traverso player and recorder player.
And, of course, the flute quartets will not be the usual ones that everybody plays, namely the Parisian quartets, but they will be some a couple of them are quite obscure, little-known, one with two scordatura, mistuned violins, and two others that may have been played and have been recorded in previous times. But so we're always trying to go a little bit away from the too well-traveled path.
Mm-hmm. Ever rebellious.
Of course.
Perhaps so. got to stay true to your colors, you know. Stripes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't wait to hear these projects that you have coming up, particularly that Kingdoms and Viceroys program sounds really appealing.
Oh, that should be very special, yes.
Yeah, sound wonderful. So,
the first time we're actually working with a percussionist, so that'll be really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and is that scheduled for recording, that particular program?
Not at the moment, depending upon the success of the tour, which I have every reason to expect is going to be successful, we may actually discuss plans to record it, because the program is actually being curated by Richard Savino, because that's his field of interest
and expertise.
Mm-hmm. So we'll take it from there. We'll see how it works, and I have every reason to believe it's going to be a great program.
Super. Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking time to speak with me, and wish you lots of wonderful luck with these upcoming performances and with these recording projects as well.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.